Aftermath. The Red Army reached Colditz in May 1945. The town was now in the Russian zone, which would become the GDR, or East Germany, in 1949. Colditz was used, variously, as a prison camp for local criminals and others deemed undesirable by the communist state, a psychiatric hospital, an old people's home, and a storehouse for excess stock from the ceramics factory. The radio hide, bricked up when the wartime prisoners departed, was rediscovered in 1965, with the radio intact. The Colditz glider vanished after the war. No one knows its precise fate. At a time of scarcity in eastern Germany, it may have been chopped up for firewood. In 2012, a full-size remote-controlled replica was launched from the roof of Colditz and landed safely in the meadow over the river. The great collection of objects and photographs amassed by Reinhold Eggers was dispersed, many of them sold as souvenirs to visitors. Starting in 2006, the castle was refurbished and remodeled, leading to the discovery of many more wartime artifacts, escape aids, and hiding places in the walls and roofs and under floors. The chapel was recently restored, leaving part of the French metro tunnel visible through a glass floor. Colditz now houses a small museum. Life-size cardboard cutouts of Airy Neave and Douglas Bader stand in the inner courtyard, where the prisoners once played stoolball. The German barracks, the Kommandantur, is now a youth hostel. The wartime history of Colditz is little known in Germany, despite its mythical status among the countries whose prisoners were held there. The precise number of successful escapers is still debated, depending on whether the total includes escapes that took place when prisoners were in transit or as a result of repatriation on false pretenses. The best estimate is that a total of 32 men made home runs, with just 15 starting from inside the castle. 11 British, 12 French, 7 Dutch, 1 Pole, and a Belgian. The last surviving inmate, Alan Campbell, who wrote poetry in Colditz and acted as the prisoner's senior legal advisor, died in 2013. But while the living memories of Colditz are gone, the story continues to emerge and evolve in declassified files, unpublished memoirs, diaries, and letters. After the war, Pat Reed worked as an MI6 officer under diplomatic cover in the British Embassy in Ankara, before returning to Britain and resuming a career in civil engineering. His first book, The Colditz Story, was published in 1952. An instant bestseller, it was followed by two more, adventure narratives written in a breathless, engaging style, replete with tales of gallant escapes, schoolboy humour, and cheerful derring-do. If you feel in the mood to launch into the feverish underground activity of a camp full of diehards, read on. Reed's writings formed the foundations of the Colditz industry. His books offered an account of prison camp life that was relentlessly upbeat, full of boyish enthusiasm, comic interludes, and plucky high spirits. Uncomplicated and irrepressible, Reed came to embody the place as the archetypal Colditz prisoner, leaving the false impression that everyone in it had been just like him. Reed had always treated escaping as a game, and the popular image he forged of Colditz was powerful and enduring. It was also highly subjective and partly inaccurate. Reed's book was adapted into a film starring John Mills as Reed. Not all former prisoners were pleased with the result. Airy Neave was furious that his own escape, the first by a British officer, was eclipsed in favour of the author's. Reed was technical advisor on the BBC television series Colditz, which ran from 1972 to 1974, starring David McCallum and Robert Wagner. This was the most successful television drama the BBC had ever broadcast, with an average of 7 million viewers, over one-third of the entire British viewing public tuning in to watch every week. Again, the series was not universally popular with ex-prisoners, but Reed's version was now firmly established and ripe for parody. In The Times, Alan Corran began his review, "Hurrah! The Christmas haul's over. It was back to the fifth form at St. Colditz for a new term." Reed cooperated with an advertising campaign for Galaxy Ripple chocolate bars featuring a Colditz escape map, wrote a children's book entitled My Favourite Escape Stories, and conducted lecture tours using a model of the castle and various memorabilia as props. He even authorised a gramophone record, Colditz Breakpoint, a soundscape of songs, music, speeches and general military background noise. "It will be something new," promised Reed on the sleeve notes, "a very personal experience which you will live in your imagination as a prisoner with me in Colditz." In 1973, Gibson's Games released a board game, Escape from Colditz, which bore the legend, "Devised by Major P.R. Reed, MBE, MC," and his signature. For a time, it was more popular than Monopoly. Reed made a small fortune and a large reputation from his wartime imprisonment, married three times, and died in 1990 at the age of 79. Reed put Colditz on the map and permanently embedded it in popular culture. At the Nuremberg trials, Airy Neave, now a lawyer on the International Military Tribunal and a revered war hero, read out the indictments against the accused Nazi leaders. In 1953, he was elected Conservative MP for Abingdon and went on to become one of Margaret Thatcher's most trusted advisers. Neave advocated defeating republicanism in Northern Ireland by military means, a hawkish stance that earned him the hatred of the IRA and other paramilitary groups seeking an end to British rule. It was widely expected that if Thatcher became Prime Minister, she would appoint him Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. On the 30th of March 1979, a month before the general election that brought Thatcher to power, Neave was killed when a bomb exploded beneath his car as he was leaving Parliament. The paramilitary Irish National Liberation Army claimed responsibility for the assassination. Thatcher was devastated by Neave's death. "He was one of freedom's warriors," she said. "He was staunch, brave, true, strong, but he was very gentle and kind and loyal. It's a rare combination of qualities." 2 weeks after returning from Germany, Alex Ross was back at his family home in Scotland when he was summoned to the local post office in Tain to take a long-distance call from Douglas Bader. Throughout their shared captivity, Ross had carried Bader up and down stairs, cooked his meals and washed his stump socks. At Bader's insistence, the orderly had remained in Colditz an additional 2 years. At last, he thought, Bader was calling to express his gratitude. "Have you got my legs?" demanded the wing commander. Ross explained that the American liberators of Colditz had permitted each man to take away only a single suitcase, and the spare tin legs had been left behind. "You're a cunt," said Bader, and rang off. Ross worked as an army dispatch rider, then in a brickfield, and finally ran an ironmonger's shop in High Brooms, Kent. He never spoke to Bader again. Douglas Bader's fame continued to soar after the war. In June 1945, the disabled flying ace led a victory flypast over London of 400 planes. A biography by Paul Brickhill, Reach for the Sky, painted him in colours of unalloyed glory and became the biggest-selling hardback in post-war Britain. It was later made into a film starring Kenneth Moore, which smoothed out Bader's jagged personality. Bader declined to stand as a Tory MP, stating that the only political job he was interested in would be that of Prime Minister. He continually expressed his opinions as truths, which made him outspoken or appalling, depending on your point of view. He praised apartheid in South Africa, supported the white minority regime in Rhodesia, favoured the return of the death penalty, and opposed immigration. He became friends with former foes, but at an Anglo-German gathering of war veterans in Munich, he glared around a beer cellar filled with former Luftwaffe pilots and loudly remarked, "My God, I had no idea we left so many of the bastards alive." But he had moments of humility and many more of generosity. His fame, he admitted, had come about not because I was better than others, but because I was the chap with the tin legs. He used his celebrity well. Douglas Bader's stubborn and courageous refusal to allow physical impairment to inhibit his freedom became an inspiration to disabled and limbless people everywhere. He raised millions for charity. I am just grateful that my story is known because it has enabled me to do the really worthwhile thing in life, which is to have helped some others who had the same problem I had in 1931. He died in 1982, a total hero and, at times, a complete bastard. In the closing months of the war, Walter Purdy worked for the SS as a translator and wrote propaganda leaflets for the Gestapo. His application for German citizenship was turned down. Gretel gave birth to a son in June 1945. By that point, even this monumentally unperceptive man had twigged he might be in trouble. With the end of hostilities, he was picked up by American forces and returned to Britain, where he settled in a bedsit in Putney, living off a disability pension and passing his time in seedy pubs. Drunk one night, Purdy boasted to Betty Blaney, a 31-year-old telephonist, about his wartime broadcasting for the Nazis. Betty tried to blackmail him. He reported this to the police, and both were arrested. She for extortion, and he for treason. Purdy came quietly. "I know I have been a bit of a sod in Germany," he told the arresting officers. On the 18th of December, he appeared in the dock of the Old Bailey on three counts of high treason. Purdy's defence was part fantasy and part fabrication. He had been secretly working for the Allies all along and sending messages back to Britain from a concealed wireless. He had carried out a series of sabotage missions on German targets. He even claimed to have plotted to kill William Joyce, Lord Haw-Haw, with a hand grenade. The Attorney General, Sir Hartley Shawcross, dismissed his testimony as a mass of inconsistencies, improbabilities, and contradictions. Julius Green attended the trial and remarked, "His whining protestations of patriotism and ludicrous attempts to explain his treasonable activities fooled no one." The jury took 17 minutes to find him guilty. The judge described the accused as a weak and vain man who decided to sell himself to the enemy. Walter Purdy was sentenced to death. Joyce was hanged on the 3rd of January 1946. Purdy's execution was set for the 8th of February. The executioner, Albert Pierpoint, was summoned to Wandsworth Jail, but 36 hours before Purdy's appointment with the hangman, his sentence was commuted to life imprisonment. The proof of treason was overwhelming, but the Home Secretary ruled there was insufficient evidence to convict him on the specific charge of betraying the Colditz prisoners. For a second time, Green felt relieved that Purdy had escaped the noose. "It was obvious to me during the trial that he was not an intellectual giant." To Green's way of thinking, killing a man for being very stupid seemed unfair. Purdy was released in November 1954 after 9 years in prison. He changed his name to Robert Poynter, married twice, had another son, and settled in Essex, where he worked for a water softener firm and then as a vehicle inspector at Ford's Dagenham factory. He told his family he had served on submarines during the war He died in 1982, and his secret remained hidden for a further 26 years. In 2008, MI5 declassified his case files, including an internal Home Office memo describing Walter Purdy as the greatest rogue unhung. Reinhold Eggers was interrogated by US officials and was released 4 months later after demonstrating that he had never been a member of the Nazi Party. He returned home and resumed his old job as a schoolmaster. Haller, like Colditz, lay within the Soviet occupation zone that would become East Germany. Oberstleutnant Gerhard Pravitt, the last commandant of Colditz, slipped into West Germany with his family before the Iron Curtain came down and settled near Hamburg, where he died in 1969. Eggers considered a similar move, but decided he was in no danger. "I had been no Hitler man," he wrote. "The communists had nothing against me." In 1946, he was arrested and interrogated by the NKVD, Stalin's ruthless security service. The Russians were convinced that, as the security officer in Colditz, he must have worked with the Gestapo, running spies among the prisoners. When he insisted that only three inmates, notably Walter Purdy, had been willing to spy for Germany, they were scornful. "We'll send you to Siberia, and then the names of your agents will come back to your memory." A Soviet military tribunal sentenced Eggers to 10 years hard labour for aiding the fascist regime. He was sent to Sachsenhausen, the former concentration camp where the commandos of Operation Musketoon had been murdered. Here, the brutality far exceeded anything prisoners had endured in Colditz. At least 12,000 of those crammed into NKVD Special Camp No. 1 perished of disease and malnutrition within 5 years. Chained up with common criminals and Nazis, starved and beaten, the fastidious schoolmaster could not believe where fate and bad luck had landed him. In this hell, morals and manners deteriorated into rough violence. By 1951, Eggers was one of just 1,500 survivors, skeletons weighing no more than 50 kilograms. He was finally released in December 1955 and ordered to leave East Germany, having spent twice as long in prison as any Colditz inmate. Eggers settled by Lake Constance, where he died in 1974 at the age of 84. Throughout her husband's long imprisonment, Margaret Eggers preserved his diaries, photographs, and notes. "It would have been far safer for her to have burned all my papers, but she saved them," he wrote. In the wake of Pat Reed's publishing success, Eggers wrote his own memoir, Colditz, The German Viewpoint, which he followed up with a collection of reminiscences gathered from Allied prisoners and German guards. He kept in touch with many of those he had once guarded. "I found new friends among my former enemies." In his writings, Eggers offered a counterpoint to the dominant British perspective, as sober and precise as Reed's was jovial and impressionistic. Eggers had stuck to the rules and made Colditz a tolerable place to be imprisoned, but he had also done more than anyone else to prevent escapers getting out. Colditz was the bad boys' camp, and the schoolteacher Eggers saw his role as keeping them in line. This made him a dangerous adversary and quite irritating. Among ex-prisoners, he was a divisive figure, loathed by some for his cunning and efficiency, but admired by others for retaining his humanity in an inhuman war. This man was our opponent, but nevertheless, he earned our respect by his correct attitude, self-control, and total lack of rancour despite all the harassment we gave him, wrote one former inmate. When Pat Reed appeared on the British TV programme This Is Your Life, the surprise guest was Reinhold Eggers. SS Obergruppenführer Gottlob Berger was arrested by French forces a week after throwing his grotesque party for the Prominente, in the Bavarian mountains. Brought to trial at Nuremberg, he claimed he had resisted pressure to inflict harsher treatment on POWs and disobeyed Hitler's direct order to kill them all. His role in delivering the Prominente to safety formed a central plank of his defence, and he insisted he had risked his life by defying the Führer. In April 1949, the tribunal found him guilty of genocide as an active party in the programme of persecution, enslavement and murder of European Jews. The court found that he also bore command responsibility for the assassination of French General Gustave Meyni. Berger was sentenced to 25 years in prison. But on appeal, 2 years later, the advisory board for clemency ruled that insufficient weight had been given to Berger's actions in the final days of the Nazi regime. The defendant Berger was the means of saving the lives of American, British and Allied officers and men whose safety was gravely imperiled by orders of Hitler that they be liquidated or held as hostages. Berger disobeyed and intervened on their behalf, and in so doing placed himself in a position of hazard. The sentence was reduced to 10 years, and he was released in 1951, having served just 6. Berger worked in a curtain factory, wrote occasional articles for a right-wing magazine, and died at the age of 78. SS-Oberst Fritz Meurer, Berger's chief of staff, went on the run. In 1953, a French court found him guilty in absentia of General Meyni's murder and issued an international warrant for his arrest. He was briefly imprisoned in Germany, but the investigation dragged on for years, and in 1975, Meurer was declared unfit to stand trial. One of Lee Carson's last articles from Germany related the fate of Paul Boudin, the general manager of Hassag, the arms manufacturer that had worked hundreds of Jewish labourers to death in the Colditz slave camp. "Something strange, almost unbelievable, happened here Wednesday night," she wrote from Leipzig, 5 days after the liberation of Colditz. Carson described how the arms manufacturer and SS officer had hosted a party in his large Leipzig mansion. Frightened by the approach of the Americans, as most good Nazis are frightened, and realizing that his factories and his life as Hitler's favorite were over, he invited his friends to an elaborate banquet. It was complete with champagne, caviar, and all the trimmings. A gay time was had by all. The guests numbered around 100 people, among them Boudin's wife and children. Then, after the gentlemen had smoked their cigars and lingered over fine French cognac, Boudin touched a button, which blasted himself and his friends to Valhalla. The banquet room had been mined and set for push-button detonation. The explosion also destroyed the Hassag company files, including the record of how many enslaved labourers had perished at Außen Kommando 24 in Colditz. When American forces finally linked up with the Soviets at the Elbe River, Carson was there to report it. She never forgot the sight of the dead boy sprawled on the bridge at Colditz. In the mad melee, Americans fought grey-bearded men and children, while thousands of trained Nazi soldiers surrendered, she wrote. On her return to the US in 1946, she was awarded the International News Service Medal of Honor. Lee Carson retired from journalism in 1957, married a CIA officer, and died of cancer, aged 51, in 1973. Her funeral in Philadelphia was attended by her fellow war reporters, still drooling over her combination of looks and talent. "Miss Carson was built like a movie star," wrote one. It can be argued whether Lee was the greatest woman war correspondent of World War II, but there is no question that she was the best-liked news chick who ever beat a male reporter to a story, or the best seat in the Jeep. In October 1945, Mickey Byrne received a letter from his one-time lover, Ella van Heemstra. Her family had suffered grievously under Nazi occupation, and Ella's daughter, Audrey, who had dreams of becoming a dancer, was suffering from jaundice, anemia, and an infection caused by malnutrition. Ella asked Byrne if he could help her obtain penicillin, a wonder drug that might save Audrey's life. Byrne sent thousands of cigarettes, which van Heemstra sold on the black market and bought the medicine. The girl recovered and went on to become an actress. She's better known as Audrey Hepburn. Byrne remained a man of erratic, short-lived passions, political and sexual. He returned from Colditz convinced he was exclusively attracted to men, but then immediately fell in love with a woman, to whom he remained married, despite his several homosexual liaisons, for the next 3 decades. He embraced Catholicism, but then renounced the faith over the church's stance on homosexuality. He campaigned for the Communist Party, but then disavowed Marxism too, after witnessing the reality of communist rule firsthand as a correspondent for The Times in Budapest and Belgrade. His communist convictions were badly shaken by the defection of the KGB spy Guy Burgess, his former lover. His Colditz novel, Yes, Farewell, was published in 1946, the first of many books, plays and poems. He moved to Wales, where he established a mussel farming cooperative run on socialist principles in Porthmadog Harbour. It was a financial disaster. Reviewing his 2003 autobiography, Turned Towards the Sun, The Times observed that the book's moral is that there are no easy answers to the paradoxes with which existence is constantly confronting the human tenants of this planet. Nazi sympathiser turned communist, journalist turned novelist, muscle breeder, commando, poet, dilettante, and scribe of the secret Colditz radio, Mickey Byrne was never bored and continued to try everything at least once until his death at the age of 97. Czenek Kalupka, seducer, spy runner, and black marketeer, did not marry Irma Wernicke after the war, an outcome that surprised nobody who knew him, except, perhaps, Irma herself. Czeko somehow obtained a Spitfire and flew back to Czechoslovakia in it. He rejoined the Czech Air Force and served in the 1st Air Division near Prague. In February 1946, 10 months after leaving Colditz, he took a C-2 aircraft on a training flight and crashed. He was killed instantly. Years later, it emerged that Kalupka had never been an officer at all. Irma Wernicke got out of Colditz just before the Soviets moved in. The truth about her espionage activities on behalf of the prisoners was emerging. The town was suffused with bad blood. And once it became clear that she would not be living under Allied protection, the dental assistant knew she, too, had to escape. On the night the Red Army arrived, she fled, under cover of darkness. She was living in West Germany and working as a dental nurse when she met Tony Kudelka, another dashing Czech adventurer, an army deserter and former soldier in the French Foreign Legion. They married in 1953, emigrated to the US and settled in Castaic, north of Los Angeles, where Kudelka joined the LAPD and moonlighted as a security guard for future President Ronald Reagan. She worked as a dentist for a trade union. In 1993, a year before Irma's death, a collection of former prisoners presented her with a signed book of Colditz photographs. To remember her unique courage in helping us during the uncertain days of long ago, and to thank her with all sincerity on behalf of every Allied officer who was confined in Colditz Castle and for whom she risked her life. Julius Green returned to Scotland, where he married Anne Miller. They had 2 sons and spent the rest of their lives in Glasgow. He briefly entered business, but resumed his dental practice in 1950. In 1971, he he published From Colditz in Code, a memoir of wry self-mockery and quiet fortitude. Green died in 1990, aged 77. His history remains all but unknown, eclipsed by the tales of louder and more obvious actors. But then, history is like dentistry. You never quite know what you will find until you drill down. With a large private income and a larger determination to enjoy himself, Michael Alexander became a pillar of the group of bohemian writers and artists known as the Chelsea Set. An inveterate ladies' man, he happily reminisced about the sexual experiences with men he had enjoyed in Colditz. In a hovercraft, he explored the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico and the upper reaches of the Ganges. He circumnavigated the coast of Scotland in a small inflatable boat. Alexander worked for various publishers, rescued an old friend from the French Foreign Legion in North Africa, founded the British Inflatable Boat Owners Association, located the remote area of Firouzkou in central Afghanistan, and was elected a Fellow of the Zoological Society of London. But he never did anything that might have been mistaken for a job. His literary output was vast and eclectic, including an anthology on India, a book about Hogarth's engravings, and a biography of Duleep Singh, Queen Victoria's Indian protege. He opened a restaurant, briefly, married, briefly, and lived in a derelict Scottish castle, briefest of all. Having endured drab imprisonment for so long, he spent life after Colditz exploring as many of its colours and flavours as he could find. Back in London, Floriman Duke checked in with OSS and had one fine dinner in Claridge's before he flew home. He was writing up his report on Mission Sparrow in Washington when some unexpected news arrived from Hungary, now under Soviet control. A Hungarian military officer had approached an American diplomat in the street. "I have $6,000 in gold belonging to one of your officers," he said, in a North American accent. "I want to return it before the Russians get their hands on it." Major Kirai dropped off the money at the American military mission the next day, declined a receipt, and then disappeared. Duke moved to New Hampshire, where he served on the legislature, and then retired to Scottsdale, Arizona. Every year, on the 15th of April, he joined Colonel Leo Shaughnessy to celebrate the anniversary of the liberation of Colditz. "My task force did not capture Colditz," Shaughnessy insisted. "The prisoners had already done so." Duke had never been one for philosophical introspection, but as he grew older, he began to wonder, "How did I survive?" In a book published shortly after his death in 1969, he wrote, "Part of it was just plain luck, but part of the answer lies with the true protective power of men of goodwill and high moral purpose, men like Denzler." Rudolf E. Denzler never received any recognition for his wartime achievements and never sought any. In a conflict involving, as he put it, all the power, cruelty, and inhumanity inherent in modern warfare, he was proud that inside Colditz he had managed to uphold the rules he venerated. In this limited area, the spirit of chivalry of the 1929 Geneva Convention lived on. Having saved so many lives, with so little fanfare, he quietly slipped back into the anonymity of Swiss bureaucracy. Michael Sinclair was posthumously awarded the DSO for his relentless devotion to escaping whilst a POW, becoming the only lieutenant to receive a medal for courage during captivity. In 1947, his remains were moved to the Berlin War Cemetery. Charles Hopeton and Doik Haig, too ill to be moved from Königstein with the other Prominente, both recovered and were subsequently liberated by American forces. Hopeton became director of an insurance company and third Marquess of Linlithgow. Haig had a breakdown after the war. A fine modern painter who never quite escaped the shadow of his famous father. Grizz Davis Scarfield remained in the army, serving in Germany, Malaya, Ghana, and Cyprus, and ended his career as a brigadier. Jack Best resumed farming, first in Kenya and then Hertfordshire. The orderly Solly Goldman emigrated to the US and swapped his Cockney accent for an entirely American one. Tony Rolt returned to the motor racing circuit and competed in 3 Formula One World Championship races. Peter Allen, the diminutive, kilt-wearing Scotsman who had staged the first escape inside a mattress, became a travelling representative for Bell's Scotch Whisky. Michiel van den Hervel was promoted to major in the Dutch Army and killed in action in 1946 during the Indonesian War of Independence. Tony Lutyn settled in Australia. Hans Lariva took a job with Royal Dutch Shell. General Tadeusz Boer Komorowski never returned to Poland. In London, he was Prime Minister of the Polish government in exile from 1947 to 1949 and an upholsterer. The French cavalry officer Pierre Meres Lebrun served in de Gaulle's intelligence service and spent much of the rest of his life on horseback. As local commander of the Force Française de l'Intérieur, Alain Le Ray liberated the city of Grenoble and prized the last German forces out of the Alpine forts. The first Colditz escaper served in Indochina and Algeria and retired in 1970 with the rank of general. David Sterling founded a number of failed businesses, took part in covert military actions in the Middle East, and was knighted in 1990, the year he died. His SAS became the model for special forces worldwide. The inventor, Christopher Clayton Hutton, attempted to publish a memoir describing the escape tools he had created for MI9, but became, in his words, enmeshed in a labyrinth of minor officials and threatened with prosecution under the Official Secrets Act. His autobiography, Official Secret, was finally published in 1960. Clutty retired to the eastern edge of Dartmoor, passed days on end inventing things in his shed, and died in 1965. His escape aids have become sought-after collector's items. Frank Flynn never fully recovered from the experience of Colditz, and was one of the few to admit it honestly. A gentle, shy man, he had escaped by being declared insane, and his mental health remained fragile. "The long-term effects were definitely there," he said. "Horizons shrink when you are in prison, and all the things around you make sense, but you get into a wider world, and the traffic is too noisy. Your mind is attuned to four walls, and it expands too rapidly." He was pronounced unfit to fly and left the RAF at the end of 1945, suffering from acute survivor's guilt. "You're alive, but so many have died," he said. "I don't think I really came to terms with it." Errol Flynn established a business making syrup for the ice cream industry in St. Helens before opening a kitchenware shop in Southport. He died in 2013 at the age of 97. Giles Romilly, the first of the Prominente to be incarcerated and the only one to escape under his own steam, was also irreparably damaged by imprisonment. He developed claustrophobia and a heightened fear of crowds. Doctors prescribed barbituric acid, and he became addicted. With Michael Alexander, he co-wrote a book about the Colditz experience entitled The Privileged Nightmare, but his journalistic and literary career failed to take off. His marriage disintegrated in acrimony, and in 1963 he kidnapped his 2 children and fled to America. A year later, he sent them back. His ex-wife sequestered his property and assets. Churchill's communist nephew survived by selling Bibles and the Encyclopaedia Britannica door to door. The addiction worsened. His whole life revolved around Drynamil, sodium amytal, and Nembutal, said his son. In 1967, he died at the age of 50 from an overdose of tranquilizers in a lonely hotel room in Berkeley, California. While some were changed forever by Colditz, Padre Jock Platt, armored by his Christian beliefs, emerged virtually unaffected. Imprisonment had been a trial sent by God, and he had met it. After the war, he served as a Methodist minister in St. Leonard's, Bromley, and Somerset, before retiring to Dorchester, where he died in 1973, a man of deep faith who could never be turned away from his convictions. The redoubtable Jane Walker was still hiding in a Polish village on the banks of the Vistula when the Red Army marched through on its way to Berlin. Mrs. M had no intention of living under Soviet rule in communist-controlled Poland, and the 71-year-old spy decided it was time to go home. She made her way to Lublin and hitched a ride on a boxcar with a POW transport headed for Ukraine. On the way, she obtained a fresh disguise and, as the Times reported, presented herself at the British military mission in Odessa, dressed, curiously enough, as an NCO in the RAF. There, she boarded a British ship for Port Said, and on the 22nd of April 1945, she docked in Gourock, the first time she had seen her native land in four decades. Walker was appointed MBE for helping hundreds of Allied prisoners escape from German-occupied territory, received a personal invitation to the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II, appeared on the BBC show This Is Your Life, and retired to Bexhill-on-Sea on the Sussex coast, where she died at the age of 85. "She was a great patriot," wrote Grizz Davis Scarfield, one of many who owed his survival to Mrs. M. "She lives on in the memories of all who knew and loved her in dark and dangerous days." Birendranath Mazumdar was held for 4 months under house arrest in a Swiss hotel, awaiting trial on charges of embezzlement. Finally, the Swiss colonel overseeing the care of British soldiers in Switzerland came to see him. "They want me to be removed from the medical register and ruin my whole life," Mazumdar told him. The Swiss officer arranged for the Indian doctor to be moved to a nursing home. "They can't court-martial you now," he said. In November 1944, he was transferred to Marseille and put on a troop ship back to England. Colonel Foote, meanwhile, had written to Z section of MI5, suggesting that the behaviour of Captain Mazumdar gave rise to suspicion. He had been back in Woolwich Barracks for just 2 weeks, when the suspect, now identified as Z240, in a file labelled Indian Subversion, was summoned to the War Office. Z240 was very hard to deal with, wrote the MI5 officer who conducted the cross-examination. He disliked being interviewed and expressed the opinion that he was being subjected to treatment that no British POW had to put up with. Reluctantly, Mazumdar described again the failed attempts to recruit him in Berlin. The interviewer concluded that Mazumdar posed no security threat and deserved credit for remaining loyal, yet the odour of suspicion still clung to him. "It seems impossible that Z240 has forgotten as much as he pretends." "You are ruining your chances of getting a medal," the MI5 officer warned. Mazumdar exploded. "Do you think I escaped and went through all these things just to get a bloody medal?" he shouted, and walked out. Biren Mazumdar was discharged in 1946. By then, Subhas Chandra Bose was dead. His Indian National Army had fought the British in Burma and then surrendered with the Japanese. In circumstances that have never been fully explained, a plane carrying the Indian nationalist leader crashed in August 1945 in what is now Taiwan. Bose died from third-degree burns. In 1947, India won its independence. Mazumdar might now have returned to the country of his birth, no longer under British rule, but instead he chose to remain in England. In the bank one day, he was served by an attractive young cashier named Joan, who recalled their first meeting. He stood there at the counter. He was always beautifully groomed, three-piece suit, gloves, never smoked without his gloves on. They married and moved to Wales, where Mazumdar worked as a GP, and later to Essex. They had two sons. After Biren's retirement, the Mazumdars settled in the little village of Gampton, in Devon. He seldom talked about Colditz, but before his death in 1996, Mazumdar made a series of tape recordings describing his wartime experiences. In one of these, he recalled a highly symbolic incident. Shortly before Indian independence, and still in British uniform, Mazumdar visited his hometown of Gaya. His brother's family was also staying in the family house, and on the day they were leaving, Biren bought first-class tickets at the station, installed them in a compartment on the train to Calcutta, and went to buy food for their journey. He arrived back at the platform to see his relatives being hustled out of their first-class seats by a British sergeant major to make way for an Englishman and his mistress. "What happened?" Mazumdar asked. "They told me to get out," his brother replied. Mazumdar rounded on the British soldier and gave vent to all the frustrations built up over so many years of captivity and prejudice. "Stand to attention. Salute a senior officer." His tirade continued for several minutes as the soldier cowered. "You are dismissed." Mazumdar turned. The packed platform had fallen silent. The porters had dropped their bundles, and the Indian crowd was staring in awe. Then the applause started, building to a deafening roar as they stamped their feet and cheered. "Shabash!" they shouted. "Shabash!"